He's singing. Which direction we are going?
You're afraid. Don't be. You have all the weapons you need.
Into the further you go.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Into the Further, the podcast where we meditate on the art of filmmaking as well as the themes and deeper ideas of all our favorite films and what they mean to us. I am your host or guide, Gwendolyn J. Stone, and today, before I get into the introduction of our guest, I would like to talk about a few audio snags that happened during the editing process. The audio is not as perfect as I would like it to be, but I think I got it to a really good place. We had a couple technical difficulties, and there was a minor bit of construction going on in the background, but I think I managed to get most of it, if not all of it, out of the way. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get into the introduction of my friend and guest, Krista Michaels.
Hi, everyone. I'm Krista Michaels. I'm a trans girl and a filmmaker. I really like horror movies. I've just wrapped up production on my second short film, a little horror short called Mantid, about an alien mantid being that attacks a family during the night. A little exploitation, but fun. My first short was called One Monday, and it's only about 2.5-3 minutes and deals with mental health and you know, other issues, not to give anything away, but yeah, you can check any of those out if you go to my pages. But yeah, I'm glad to be here. This is the first time that Gwen and I have spoken, so yeah, excited.
Today, we're going to be talking about Sucker Punch.
Begin your journey. It will set you free.
If you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything.
Sucker Punch is a 2011 film from director Zack Snyder. It's co-written by him and Steve Shibuya, with stunning cinematography from Larry Fong, as well as a killer soundtrack from the likes of Tyler Bates, Bjork, Emily Browning, who also stars in the film, many others. The film also stars Oscar Isaac, Carla Cugino, Jenna Malone. It's a psychological fantasy. In some sense, I guess you could call it a musical, kind of, about a young woman being institutionalized by her abusive stepfather after a series of tragedies and must fight for her freedom in several dream worlds before she's lobotomized. So I want to go ahead and talk about our experiences with the film and Zack Snyder in general. I'll go ahead and let you start.
Where to start is really the question with this one. It's a multi-layered film. And yeah. I think, you know, really to get into it, it might be best to start off with the controversies, you know, surrounding it, the critical reaction, the way the general public reacted to the film.
Yeah, it's the reaction to the film alone is very, very complicated. I would say it was pretty much panned by critics. Like, I don't think anyone really knew what to think about this movie.
Yeah, understandably so. I mean, you know, I think that's one of the things that Zack Snyder deals with a lot of his films is he doesn't do everything on the surface level. And so sometimes it takes years, you know, for people to come around to his work, you know, if they do. And yeah, it's very rewarding, I think, when you revisit his films.
Yeah, like back whenever I saw this movie, I was pretty young, probably too young to watch this movie at the time because it deals with a lot of heavy stuff.
All right. in many different directions.
Like the first movie, the first Zack Snyder movie I actually saw was Legend of the Guardians, but you know, this was the second one. I still didn't know who Zack Snyder was. Like I kind of I had an idea, like he's a guy that made 300, but I never saw that movie at the time. And I remember seeing TV spots for Sucker Punch and being like, oh, this kind of looks fun. Like it would be a fun movie to watch. I didn't get around to see it in the theaters, but I rented it and brought it home one day. It was a PG-13 movie, so no one really thought of anything. And I was kind of shocked because it's just dealing with like sexual abuse, misogyny. It, like most of the movie takes place in a brothel, interspersed with all these fantasy worlds. For a first-time watch, especially whenever you're a teenager, it's very hard to take everything in and just...
Oh, absolutely.
...really understand what the movie's saying. And then, of course, my family was watching the movie with me, and they're just like, what the hell is this? It did strike me, though, because after it was over, it was kind of one of those movies that, even though I didn't understand it, I knew I wanted to come back to at some point.
Right.
What was kind of your experience whenever you saw it?
I saw it years after it came out. I want to say maybe 2014, 2015, something like that. Obviously, you know, I'm not going to lie. A lot of stuff went over my head. Mm-hmm. I know like when you're dealing with traumatic events, like it, you know, a lot of people are prone to blocking it out,
mm-hmm.
You know, creating their own worlds, perhaps not as adventurous as we see in the film. And I think that's one of the interesting things about the initial perception for a lot of people is you saw the trailers and, you know, the marketing for the film, you might think it is just another pop culture action adventure film with, you know, I think Zach described it as Alice in Wonderland with machine guns, which I thought was interesting.
I think that's an apt description.
Whimsical, to say the least.
Yeah, once you kind of get over that initial experience of the movie, if you're not one of the people that just kind of shut down the entire thing and refused to ever watch it again, like some people did, that happens with a lot of misunderstood movies, unfortunately. But, you know, like some misunderstood movies... Hopefully, eventually, there's a lot of reevaluation, and it kind of is remembered more fondly over time. I mean, that's happened with a lot of movies. I mean, movies we consider classics today are movies that were, like, reviled back when they came out. I mean, John Carpenter's The Thing is a major example of that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in this case, the movie is just... There's really, like, three different layers of... reality kind of happening here, and depending on who you ask, there's a fourth one that we're not really seeing. I don't know if I subscribe to that idea specifically, but
of the fourth layer.
Yeah but I mostly just analyze what's there for me to see, and whatever's not there, stuff like that, that's more not my territory. The first thing we see, and also I need to point out, I actually watched the movie last night in preparation with Sucker Punch. I also watched Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge, which Zack Snyder actually said somewhere that there was definitely inspiration from that, like with crafting the dances and stuff like that. And you can tell that that's there. But
I mean, it's a musical masterpiece as well. I mean,
yeah.
So, yeah, the parallels there is pretty uncanny.
Oh, absolutely. And then, like, you know, the big thing is, like, you see these parallels from, like, the moment the movie starts, because they both open up with the credits happening in, like, a roll curtain theater room situation.
Right into the bedroom, I believe.
Yeah. And Moulin Rouge starts like that too, like the curtains roll, and then you have like the 20th Century Fox fanfare and everything, and then the movie starts. Then Sucker Punch does the same thing, but you actually have a voiceover from a character we later discover to be Sweet Pea, like a narration happening, explaining the certain figures or people in our life, like angels that just kind of come out of nowhere. And
definitely talk about the angels. And I think it's very important, the fact that, you know, it is Sweet Pea who's doing the voiceover and not Baby Doll.
Yeah.
That says a lot about what's going on as well.
Yeah, that's interesting too. From the get-go, the movie's already unpacking a lot on you, like just from the very start, because then right after we have that, we then see Baby Doll's entire introduction. We see that her mother is dead, and her younger sister are left with their stepfather, which there's very unsettling vibes there. It's very implied that he has abused them, and not just in a normal sense. And if he hasn't yet, he is planning to. Then in the will, the mother leaves everything to her daughters, which pisses him off. He gets drunk and has a little tirade and abuses the girls, and one thing leads to another. Baby Doll, in trying to fight back, accidentally shoots her own sister, which then gets her sent to a mental institution because the stepfather wants to just erase any evidence linking him to any wrongdoing. Like, that's like in the first, like, that's just like the opening title sequence.
Right,
and
yeah.
And already you have a complete story right there. And
it can be stated, you know, the sort of traumatic freight train that you're hit with as a viewer right out the gate.
Yeah, and like, I mean, that's pretty much implied just from the title of the movie. Like, you go in expecting this fun action movie and like, wham, sucker punch with just trauma. Zack Snyder, I feel, knew that whenever he was writing the movie, that that's what it was kind of going to be like. You could even tell from the, like, looking back at the marketing, like, they marketed this movie like, yeah, we know what movie you think you're going to get. It's not going to be that. And then we're introduced to the entire institution. We're introduced to Blue, played by Oscar Isaac. Probably one of my favorite Oscar Isaac roles, because he just has so much fun playing a sadistic person. Then suddenly, once we hear about the under-the-table lobotomy that's going to be happening, Baby Doll and Sweet Pea end up locking eyes, because they kind of have, like, this kinship with each other, in a way, I guess you could say. Like, they kind of feel...
Yeah, there's tons of parallels between those two.
Yeah, I mean, we're introduced to Sweet Pea almost exactly how we were introduced to Baby Doll, because she is, you know, wearing the Baby Doll wig, she's in a bed on a stage, and then the music starts, and then we're transported to the second layer of reality. But before that, Madame Gorski, or Dr. Gorski in the actual reality, she says something about how the worlds you create can be as real as any pain. And then we're transported to this reality that Baby Doll has created for herself, where she's now not in a mental institution, but brothel that is run by Blue, who is now a pimp, basically. Like, that was the first moment where you're just kind of like, oh, it's one of those movies. Okay. Because the one interesting thing is, it goes from this very dull grayish green color palette to all of a sudden now there's all this color. And
amazing costumes.
It's yeah. Very elaborate and just beautiful to look at. And we see Sweet Pea just like freaking out, because we're basically seeing the reenactment of everything that's going to be happening to Baby Doll, where she's getting lobotomized on stage, and then she's like, oh, what the hell, this isn't hot, why are we doing this, this is about pleasuring the audience, not, we need something more commercial here. And that's very meta, that feels like the studio stepping in and like, Zach, we need to take you back a little bit, we're just gonna just try and make something more pleasing for the audience to watch here. But it's not. It's still just as fucked up.
Yes, and it should also be mentioned the various cuts as well as the potential Snyder cut that you know, hasn't been released yet.
Yeah, that's something that was brought up, is that even though there is the extended cut, which we watched, there is also another version of the movie that hasn't been released. Like, I think there's like whole new musical numbers, specifically one at the end of the movie. There is parts of this movie, even though it's still a really great movie, it's my favorite Zack Snyder movie, there are parts still missing. So hopefully someday we get the definitive cut of the film.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people have, or, you know, see a new take or, I guess, interpretation of the film after they see the extended cut, because there are some important things, which I'm sure we'll get to later, but some of the missing pieces of the puzzle are in there.
Yeah, yeah. Like, we're introduced to the other characters in the story. We're introduced to Rocket, Sweet Pea's sister, which there's a lot of parallels there between Baby Doll and her sister that become even more obvious as the movie goes along. Dr. Gorski is reintroduced as Madame Gorski, who's basically the head of the theater. And also, in a way, kind of a guardian of the girls, in a sense, because, like...
Another guardian angel.
Yeah, she's another guardian angel, but she's trying to teach these girls to survive this horrible situation they're in, because they're all being exploited by Blue and all the other men that come to his club.
Yeah, as well as herself.
Yes, yes, including her, which we'll get to that in a little bit. But, you know, we have like this whole... Rocket gives Baby Doll a tour of everything. Baby Doll is given cleaning duties and such and such. And we see the big night, the big theater night of everything that happens once Baby Doll's pretty much given the rundown of everything that goes down there. I mean, it's this very luxurious, magnificent spectacle that they give their male viewers in the club. And, like, all the women are dressed very provocatively. There's very provocative imagery, like a champagne bottle close-up that, you know, is meant to imply something very different. I'm going to let the listeners put that together themselves. then I could be wrong here, but isn't Sweet Pea's little segment in the show kind of reflecting, like, Joan of Arc a little bit?
It could be.
I feel like that's kind of what it's doing, which is interesting parallels. I don't really know. I mean, I've watched this movie many times and I'm still trying to figure everything out.
Oh, me too.
Yeah.
There's so many various ways to look at it. I mean, I've heard lots of theories and might be interesting to go into a few, but.
Yeah. And like all of this, like all the scenery that we're seeing, this rather I guess you could say very male gazy scenery, and that's intentional. It is all playing to the tune of Love is the Drug, which is sang by both Madame Gorski and Blue, which, by the way, Carlo Cugino and Oscar Isaac sound amazing. They're wonderful here, even though there's a lot of very interesting subtext just in their own performance in that moment, because it's like they're kind of having this constant battle with each other of who's in control of the situation, but she's very much being sexually exploited, whereas he is not. And then we end up getting Baby Doll's first real guardian angel moment, where she ends up hearing Rocket being attacked by the cook, and then she takes a knife to his throat and they both escape. Which, by the way, there's something else I need to point out here. The way Zach and Larry Fong frame men in this movie, it's very specific. They really want you to see these guys from the perspective of the women we're following, where it's just, they're very scary and just...
Yeah, very imposing, I would say.
Yeah, and like the makeup too. The makeup is kind of greasy a little bit. Like it's very unappealing to look at. And I mean, except for Blue, who is, you know, like it's very hard to make Oscar Isaac look bad. Very hard. I mean, I'm sure someone's done it somewhere, but it's not an easy feat. And besides, it, he's like the one guy in the movie that has like this very seductive quality to his appearance. All the other men are very just make it have the heebie-jeebies a little bit, which makes sense because they are the kind of men that would give women heebie-jeebies. But but yeah, like they're all shot in this very imposing way. It's no question who has the power in the situation. There's one thing I actually do want to bring up about whenever Baby Doll saves Rocket that I found very interesting, especially interesting for a male writer and director to illustrate so well. And I know Jenna Malone's performance goes hand in hand with this, and it's how Rocket just laughs off almost being raped. Like, as she's leaving, she just laughs it off and continues on. Like, she's very clearly traumatized, but she can't show that. And that's something that a lot of women, a lot of people who are marginalized have to go through. Just really operate the world by hiding all your emotions because you don't want to, you know, show any vulnerability to people that are going to be preying on you. And it's not until like several scenes later where she actually opens up and emotionally about what happened to her whenever she's explaining it to her sister. But like that moment there, rewatching it, I was like, oh shit, like they actually thought about this, how she's just been through this terrible traumatic event and she's having to put up a performance like it's nothing.
Right.
I
guess you could say, you know, like putting up a wall, like any of the visions in the film.
Yeah, I actually think I need to look it up, but I think there was actually talk about this from the lead actress in Dawn of the Dead. I can't remember her name right now, but she talked about something with how whenever she was in industry before like the Me Too movement happened, there was, you know, a lot of actresses and women in Hollywood who acted like all this awful, like they had to act like all this awful stuff happening to them was nothing. Like they played it off like it was funny until they realized it wasn't at all. They had been traumatized a lot and
normalized the situation.
Yeah, exactly.
So to interject a quick little editor's note here as I'm editing, I was right, actually. The actress's name was Sarah Pauli. She was the star of Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead 2004 remake, and she wrote a New York Times opinion piece called The Men You Meet Making Movies, which, I mean, by the title, it's pretty self-explanatory what the article was about, but to quote a very specific section to mention what I was talking about, Sarah Pauli states, "Several years ago, I approached a couple of successful female actors in Hollywood about an idea I had for a comedy project. We would write, direct, and star in a short film about the craziest, worst experiences we'd ever had on set. We told our stories to one another thinking they would be hysterically funny. We were full of zeal for the project, but the stories, when we told them, left us in tears and bewildered at how casually we'd taken these horror stories and tried to make them into comedy. They were stories of assault. When they were spoken out loud, it was impossible to reframe them any other way. This is how we normalized trauma, tried to integrate it by making comedy out of it. We abandoned the film, but not the project of unearthing the weight of these stories, which we'd previously hidden from ourselves." End of quote.
And that's one of the things that a movie's getting into, is how women are treated in entertainment. How they're kind of treated as second-class citizens. They're not really allowed to really feel anything. They're there solely for the pleasure of men. Again, this is something I want to pause for a minute, because we were talking earlier about the reception to this movie. I still don't understand how people watched this movie and thought it. I don't understand it. Maybe other people do, but I don't really understand how people watched this back when it came out and thought it was misogynistic.
That was a big thing. And, you know, like many of Zack Snyder's films, I think it just came out ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And I often wonder what the response might have been if it came out closer to the whole you know, Weinstein controversy, for instance, but something interesting to think about.
Yeah, I feel things would have gotten a little bit more attention if it had come out around that time. People would have been more receptive to those ideas, probably. Then again, who knows, because every movie Zack Snyder makes gets a lot of negative attention.
Right.
I actually think his first two movies are the only ones that didn't, and even then they still kind of did. It was just more under the radar.
Which can be seen as a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking about it, so.
Yeah, like, that is one thing. Like, we're talking about this movie, you know, we're actually having very, very interesting conversation about the ideas and the themes of what this movie was doing, which I don't think you can say for a lot of big action movies nowadays. Because it's not like back whenever John McTiernan was making movies where, like, his action movies did have very interesting subtext to them. A lot of action movies now are more commercial, and they're made more solely for just getting people in seats and not having to think too much for a few hours.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, a lot of filmmakers have to learn to work within.
Yeah.
That whole, you know, capitalist system, and, you know, you don't want to sell your soul completely. You want to bring art into it and interesting perspectives that you have to say, things you have to get off your chest. But also, you have to, it is a product.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that goes a lot into it. And also, I think that could be a major point of the movie.
Oh, yeah. That is a big point, I feel. Especially whenever you get into the third layer of reality that we actually see pretty much right after that, where Madame Gorski is training Baby Doll to dance. That brief little monologue that she gives with, like, are you afraid you'll be judged? You won't be. You don't think you're strong enough? You are. You have all the weapons you need. Now fight. That's really, because she's having to tell her these things, you know, through a mask almost, because Blue is right there. And she is a pro at this point. She has lived with this for years and years. She can't just straight up tell Baby Doll, listen, you need to do better here. I'm trying to help you. Like, she has to play a role while also trying to protect Baby Doll. This movie has a ton of different guardian angels in it, which is a big point of the movie, is just kind of how people come into your life and just help you in ways you weren't expecting.
Which is funny, because some of them may have been pulled out of the subconscious, so they were you all along.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, that's another thing, is, like, there's a lot of subconscious characters, like the one that we're going to be getting into next, whenever she finally goes into that third layer of reality, where she meets the wise man played by Scott Glenn, who, by the way, is fantastic. I love him so much in this movie. Because he actually has funny lines, but it's delivered with just perfect amount of dryness. Because the very first line he says is just like, shoes, you're tracking snow all over the dojo.
Right, yeah. Like,
I'm sorry, I can take... No, the time has passed. You know, like, yeah, it's really good.
I love that.
But, you know, he is the next guardian angel we're introduced to, and he then asks her what she wants, and she says she wants a way out of there, and he's like, freedom. Okay, was that so hard? I can help you out with this. These are your weapons, and then you begin your journey. And then, of course, we're given the five items that she needs. She needs the map, fire, knife, key, and then the fifth, we don't know about. It's a mystery.
Mystery item.
Yeah. And that fifth item is very key to the final act. I will admit, the first time I saw this movie, I didn't get it.
It demands repeated viewings, for sure.
Yeah. But yes, this is where we get into the action of the movie. And like always, Zack Snyder never disappoints in terms of how he directs action sequences.
Oh, it's incredible.
He always knows how to... And I mean, this is something that has been proven and true about his career ever since 300. He really knows how to work with stunt coordinators and visual effects artists to really bring something fascinating to the screen, something that you really feel like you haven't seen before. and we just get Baby Doll up against like three giant samurai, and it's
which
insane. It's insane. You know, like I love how they have this entire fight choreographed. All like she basically gets through the first two with a little bit of issues, but she gets through it, and then and all of this is to the tune of Bjork's Army of Me, which is fantastic. Like it's a great way to hype her up in a way and show how powerful she is through just even the song that's being played. And
enough to be said about the music.
The music is great. Like the needle drops in the movie, they really thought it through. They knew which songs to put where. And
oh yeah, the lyrics have a lot to do with the story as well. So
and also another interesting thing is that they use Where Is My Mind, which is most famously known from Fight Club, and that comes back later.
Right.
But like the thing I love is where she finally gets to the third samurai and like he stumbles back, you know, like he's kind of scared, and then you see his hand shake as he's reaching for his sword. Like it's just a nice little touch. There's no dialogue there, but it's just the way the action is shown visually. Baby Doll has now actually become a real force of nature.
Right. And it means so much on many levels, just mm-hmm. her taking power back. And it's really beautiful, you know, visually as well. I mean,
but... Oh yeah. Yeah. And then like, you know, she just sliced through him like it's nothing. And then we're brought back, which that's actually another thing. We only ever hear of what her dances are like. We never actually see them. And I think that was an intentional decision to kind of take anyone that was expecting to see a titillating dance of scantily clad women and just be like, you're not going to get that.
Right.
You're not. And it's kind of calling out people that wanted to see that in a way.
You do get a description from Sweet Pea about the moaning and gyrating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, everything else is left to the imagination.
Yeah, exactly. And also in that bit of dialogue, she says something of how a dance needs to be more than titillation. It needs to be something personal. It needs to mean something. What does yours say? And she's like, that I'm going to get out of here. That I'm going to escape. And then, of course, Sweet Pea is like, yeah, right. That's real cute. It's not happening. Because Sweet Pea is really the cynical character. She's someone that has seen too much and just doesn't believe that anything good can really happen. I mean,
a lot of us feel that way from time to time. So
yeah, we all feel like that, especially if, you know, we've been through serious trauma. Like, kind of like you don't want to be disappointed, so you just don't really look forward to anything in a way.
Right. And, you know, taking control and doing better for yourself just seems so far out of reach that it's just not even worth it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Then we see Rocket kind of pry a little bit, try and get her to say yes to it. And eventually Rocket opens up about what happened with the cook. And then Sweet Pea's like, okay, you saved my sister. I'm willing to humor you. I'll go ahead and take care of the map. And she alerts Blue that they're practicing dance with Baby Doll again. Like, so Blue, because he's very infatuated with Baby Doll, extremely, to a very menacing degree. And he is just like, okay, yeah, I'll walk away from everything. I'm gonna go and watch her dance. And then we see, of course, the second action sequence, which is insane. Each action scene is very wildly different from the last one. Like this one, you have steampunk Nazi zombies,
right?
Which is crazy. While all that's happening, of course, Sweet Pea is taking care of the map and everything. There's a copier in there. And this action scene is really interesting. And also, I believe it is Eli Snyder, Zack Snyder's son, that cameos in this scene. He also played young Rorschach in Watchmen. Sweet Pea stumbles upon this kid that's in the war zone. And there's kind of like this moment that's very brief between them, but it's something that comes back later as kind of a callback. Like, there's no dialogue or anything, but it's just kind of an interesting moment of Sweet Bee just kind of looking at the kid almost like, you're gonna be okay. We have this entire badass action scene where they're just mowing down Nazis, which is great.
Always great.
Yes, it's always great to see Nazis get mowed down like that. It's the reason why the Indiana Jones movies are so good, but all that happens, they get the map, which I love how they just defy physics completely, how she flings the map into the sky, and it just keeps on going and going, and they end up, you know, going on like this giant mech.
Her action sequence, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. I like,
oh, the camera work is so amazing.
Oh, the camera work's amazing, and just the imagination of like all the contents of the action sequences, it feels like something that a kid would come up with, and I mean that in a good way. Like, Zack Snyder really does have a kind of childlike imagination whenever it comes to that. Then we're brought back to the real world. Well, not the real world, the second layer, but very complicated trying to navigate that.
A brothel, right?
Yes, we go back to the second lair, and then Blue, after seeing the second dance from Baby Doll, is like, oh, she needs to be on the stage now. Like, we need to have a private dance with the mayor. And Madame Gorski is like trying to talk him down, saying that she's not ready, she's too raw. And then he just has this backhanded threat towards her.
Right, another scene showing his control over everyone.
Yeah, like, he is very clearly the one in control. And he gets very inappropriate with Madame Gorski in a very threatening manner and just persuades her, or coerces her more accurately, into having Baby Doll dance. And that is really good because Carla Gugino has to play this part in a way where she herself is someone that is an authority to the girls, and she tries to maintain that whenever talking with Blue, but then there's this very obvious fear that's underneath all of that. It's very uncomfortable to watch. And then Blue goes back to his office, and I didn't notice this for many times until I watched it again just recently, how he finds out that a pin is misplaced in the map. He leans against the copier, which is still warm. I didn't pick up on that because, you know, old copiers would get, like, really hot if you use them. And he's like, oh, of course, now it makes sense. I thought he had supernatural abilities to figure out that a pin was...
I believe there were, like, two different pinholes or something.
Yeah, because he puts on his glasses and finds out, oh, yeah, someone copied the map. Then they basically have this all set up to where she's going to dance for the mayor. What they have to do next is get fire, which is going to be in the form of his lighter for his cigars. That scene is really good because you actually do see even more the lust in the male gaze. Like, you just see their eyes and like how the cigar is just being burned up, and it's just like this big chunk of ash that falls at the end of the dance, you know. Like, it's interesting there how they film that scene, because it really shows how hypnotic Baby Doll's dance is and how they're able to get away with these crazy things with just stealing from the men in the club. And then, of course, with fire comes dragons. That makes the most sense in that situation.
Love it.
And you just have them coming in with machine guns and a plane going up against orcs and knights and dragons.
Right. I believe this is one of the extended sequences as well, right?
Yeah, they extended it in the extended cut, because I think one of the reasons they trimmed it down was like, it was apparently too brutal for a PG-13. I beg to differ. It's really not that brutal for a Zack Snyder movie.
Not at all.
And he really frames the aerial scenes really cool. I like the dog fight with the dragon. That's really fun. Also, orcs are just launched into the air, which is insane. And, like, probably the most morbid part about this scene is that they have to kill a baby dragon.
Which was intimidating on its own.
Yeah, like, it's a very dark moment. I feel like there is some kind of parallel there to... I mean, I could be off, but I feel like maybe some of Baby Doll's guilt for accidentally killing her own sister maybe played into the idea of killing a baby.
It could be symbolic of innocence.
Yeah.
Being taken away, rather.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, of course, the mother dragon gets pissed, and they had to take care of that. And that whole sequence is just a lot of fun. Because, again, you have the dogfight, and then... they had to trail the dragon back to go after Baby Doll, and then she has to, like, jump up in the air, and she stabs it right in the head with her indestructible sword. Is that sword made out of adamantium? What is it? Because it's...
It must be.
I love
that shot, too, going down the blade.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That you get to see, like, pretty much the whole design of the blade. It's a gorgeous blade.
It is.
And actually kind of... the entire story of the movie is ingrained into the blade. It's really interesting. If you study it, you actually see the dragon, you see the gun, you see all that stuff, and you actually see the lobotomy tools in there as well. Like,
I'll have to go back and check that out.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. And then, of course, we come back. The mayor is missing his lighter. Starts off this, again, very backhanded threat from Blue. Like, I don't know what's going on here, but you need to stop. Otherwise, things are going to get worse. Then that kind of freaks everyone out. Sweet Pea's like, okay, we tried it. It's over. We're not doing it anymore. Vanessa Hudgens' character, I can't remember if she's Blondie or Jamie Chung.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. Yeah, she freaks out big time. Like, she just walks off and cries at Madame Gorski's office. And she's kind of falling apart a little bit because she knows if she's caught, she's dead. And then, you know, Gorski talks to her and is like, you can trust me. You can talk to me. And then right as they start talking, Blue just walks up behind them. Again, very imposing imagery, and it really, again, once again, reestablishes the actual power dynamic of the situation. None of the women have any power here. It is all Blue. Then, to get the knife, of course, they have to steal it from the cook. They kind of haphazardly put this whole performance together, and we see where everything's going to go wrong before it happens, but, you know, you want to believe everything's still going to work out. And then in this one, you are up against alien robots. And again, it's insane. But,
train.
Yeah, on a moving train that had, like, it's on a moving bullet train with this nuclear bomb that is Operation Kitchen Knife. That's subtlety. I mean, also, the train kind of has a similar resemblance to the kitchen knife in a small way. Like, the way that the knife is shaped and everything, it kind of has a similar resemblance to the bullet train. Anyway, it all goes wrong because the water hits the cord to the radio, and the cook finds out and stabs Rocket, who gets in front of her sister, which, again, parallels Baby Doll and her sister, only now it's kind of recontextualized, in a sense, as Baby Doll, like, she still kind of doesn't want to admit to herself that she killed her sister. And so, like, whenever that happens, she dissociates again and goes back into the third layer. And she tries really hard to make this end well. And no matter what happens, Rocket's still not going to make it out of here alive. And we see her tell Sweet Pea, first thing is, don't be mad about this. And then she sends her off on a jetpack. She blows up in the train, and then we're brought back. And she says, second thing, when you get home, go back to Mom and tell her that I love her.
Which is very important.
Yes, it is very, very important for more than one reason. I mean, I guess I'll get to that later. Because, again, there's a lot of steps that you had to go to get to really the final points. But then they're kind of in shock. Sweet Pea is screaming in grief, and then of course Blue with his men come in and just are horrible. He yells at Sweet Pea and blames her for everything and pretty much locks her away in the janitor closet, then tells the rest of the girls to get ready for the show. He's such a great guy. But anyway, Jamie Chung's character, she ends up actually getting the knife, you know, off screen. Well, not totally off screen. We see the knife fall to her feet, and then we cut back and the knife is no longer there. So if you're actually paying attention to the action choreography, it's like, oh, she picked up the knife and walked out with it. Which I like how that comes back in a scene later where they're getting ready. And of course, Blue comes in and is just like, I'm not done yet. We had to reestablish the power dynamic here because clearly you've spit in my face. But what's interesting here is, like most abusers, he plays it like a mutual partnership because he's like, listen, I shelter you. I make you feel loved. All I ask is for some mutual respect. You just spit in my face for that. And then he ends up killing two of the girls and hits Gorski. He threatens to kill her too, but he doesn't because, like, that would be just bad for business. But he really makes it clear to everyone there he's still the one in control here. But of course, Baby Doll doesn't really give a shit. Like, that is the one thing throughout this entire movie. Baby Doll never respects his authority. She is the one,
which angers him greatly.
Yeah, like, she is the one person that is kind of laughing in his face. Blue is left alone with her, and his line is very disturbing. With we finally get him speaking about his infatuation with her, with how he's just like, I'm in the business of pleasure. You'd think you being so successful would make me feel pleasure, but it feels like everyone else is playing with my toys, and I want to take my toys back home with me now. And, like, he tries to assault her, and then she's reaching for the knife, and she finds it, and, like, she stops fighting him, and he doesn't like that. That's another thing, which we'll get into soon. He likes to have that kind of control where people are afraid of him, so whenever she doesn't show him that fear, it's not fun for him anymore. And so she stabs him right in the shoulder and tells him that he'll never have her no matter how badly he wants her. It's not gonna happen. And then takes the master key and goes and gets Sweet Pea. They set a fire. We kind of see parts of the first reality kind of come in. Like, we see a little bit of emerging between all of them. It's subtle, but it's there, because you go from the brothel to the institution, and then we're brought back into the brothel whenever they get to the parking lot. And you have all of these men coming through the entrance. Then it finally hits Baby Doll of what the fifth item is. And it really recontextualizes the entire movie. She is Sweet Pea's guardian angel. She has to tell Sweet Pea that she needs to go on and live her life and find her family. She's the only one that's gonna escape. And I love how, you know, whenever Baby Doll is distracting these men, her last act of defiance is just kicking one of these men straight in the balls.
Right.
It's just perfect. But yeah, Sweet Pea ends up going on and leaving as Baby Doll is left to meet the High Roller, who's been set up through this entire movie. Played by none other than John Hamm. The only other attractive man in this movie. I mean, I don't want to give Scott Glenn shit, but I mean, he's fine. He's not one of the despicable guys.
I see where
guys.
You're coming from.
Yeah. In this scene, he's basically, and this is the big difference from the theatrical cut to the extended cut, is this sequence with the High Roller. In the theatrical cut, it's made to feel more like he just assaults her in right. a way.
And we could also get into a bit why that is.
Yes. Yes. That is the big thing. I don't know how much you know. I guess you can.
Well, I saw an interview. I think there were a couple of girls there from the film. Mm-hmm. And I believe it was Emily Browning who yeah. was saying that, you know, this sequence had been cut from the film, or the MPAA wanted to cut it because mm-hmm. it made it feel like Baby Doll was enjoying this. So Zack Snyder went to rework it in the editing room, and he chopped it down to a point where it just, it seemed a little too like forced, like he was taking advantage of her, yeah. Which is not the intention. And so he wanted to cut it out.
Yeah. Like that's the thing that is very interesting, because this was another thing that they had to change to get the PG-13 rating. And I think that it's really fucked up. And also part of what the movie is commenting on is how the industry was more okay with a woman being taken advantage of than actually having any independence whatsoever in her sexuality, which is kind of backwards, but again, it's what the movie's touching on, is how, you know, women are perceived in entertainment and just in the real world in general.
Right. It's just ironic. I mean, their answer to that is the point of the film.
Yeah. This scene is really interesting because the high roller really is kind of an allegorical representation of the freedom that she's been seeking this entire film, where he's like, I'm here to offer you freedom from pain. Freedom as an abstract ideal. He goes through this entire beautiful monologue, and then we're finally brought back to the first layer of reality whenever Baby Doll consents to going through with it. John Hamm is also the lobotomist, so he's kind of taken aback because he's never seen a patient who's actually wanted this procedure. He's like, she just looked at me like she wanted it in the last moment. I haven't gotten anything like that before. This is a peculiar patient. And then he goes to Dr. Gorski and asks some questions and gets all backstory. And then Gorski finds out that Blue had been forging her signatures. Of course, since Blue in this reality is just a weaselly little bitch, he actually ends up ratting out the stepfather and everything.
Right. And who knows if they, you know, eventually even listen to him at all.
But yeah, because they might think that he's just too crazy. The big thing about this scene is whenever she's given the lobotomy, she's basically transporting herself to her own paradise in that last moment. You know, so she's not being taken advantage of by anyone else. And because, like we said earlier, Blue doesn't like it whenever there's no fight. He doesn't enjoy it. He doesn't find it fun or arousing. So whenever he is trying to do things to her in the room, nothing's happening. So that then he kind of freaks out and he's like, it's not fun anymore. She's gone. What's wrong?
It's really gross.
Yeah, like it's very upsetting to watch. And like, you see the expression in Gorski's face whenever she catches him. Like, she is deeply disgusted that her staff is doing this. He gets taken away, and we go back to her, and she closes her eyes, and then we fade to Sweet Pea getting a white dress and going to a bus station. And we see that little boy from the World War II flashback again. Well, not flashback, but third reality. It feels out of place at first, but it's really important because the police are about to catch her until we hear a familiar voice, and it is the wise man in a bus driver outfit saying, like, yeah, I had to let her use the restroom. Mine's not working. So she's been a joy the entire journey.
That was great.
And it's really beautiful, especially whenever she gets up on the bus and says, I don't have a ticket. He's like, I know, it's okay. Just go and take a seat in the back, get some rest. He, again, is one of those guardian angels that just comes in and helps her move forward. And we get this monologue at the end of how all of these things, who chains us and who gives us the strength to fight. And then it cuts to black. She says, it's you. You have all the weapons you need. Now fight. And I'm going to go ahead and give my quick interpretation. We can just talk about it more in depth. I actually think everything that we see after that baby doll scene is baby doll's paradise. Because I feel all the characters, which is strange, I know, because there is a little bit of information in the institution reality where she says, where Gorski says that she helped another patient escape. I feel what we see, though, is still a fantasy at the end, in a way, like, because there is a line in the movie that is a direct quote from Mark Twain, which is, don't part with your illusions. When they are gone, you may still exist, but you have ceased to live. So what I think actually we're seeing is just baby doll fully embracing the illusion, the world that she created, as her freedom from the torment she suffered in the real world. So whenever we see Sweet Pea getting on that bus and we see the wise man and this boy from a third reality, we're actually in that third layer, and she's finally at peace because a version of herself, which is Sweet Pea, has finally gotten to go back home. So anyway, that's my quick take. I'm gonna let you
I think that makes sense for sure. Paradise is something that's mentioned quite a few times.
Yeah.
And I think it's even shown on the billboard at the end when the
I think you're right.
But everyone has their own paradise, and you know, for Baby Doll, her paradise, and perhaps for many people out there as well, just might be to completely mentally erase the abuse that, in her case, she's received from men.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of male-dominated abusive figures in this world, in each of the phases, really. I think there's a lot of different themes in this movie, such as exploitation versus empowerment,
mm-hmm.
which is something, again, like I feel critics really missed out on. And this is something that this film is, I know it's going to be viewed even deeper into the future with new insight. You have sort of like the, I guess it's like set in the 50s, right? The normal base world. And then.
Yeah, I think something like that.
And it's, you could be set, you could say at that time that there was, you know, widespread gender inequality.
Mm-hmm.
And then again at the brothel, you know, it gets even more exploitative in a very sexualized way. And then going into like the pop culture sort of deeper world with the dragons and the robots and all this amazing stuff is sort of, it could be seen through a modern lens of the way women are viewed. And I love that portrayed as really badass. And mm-hmm. they're taking the power back. I mean, they're really fighting. It could be symbolic for taking the women taking power back in pop culture. So I think there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. There's a lot of layers. And then also, if you stick around to the end of the credits, the movie is actually dedicated to Zack Snyder's mother, Marcia. So the entire movie, I feel, is Zack Snyder kind of paying tribute to the powerful women in his life, his mother, his wife, Deborah, his daughters. I feel like he's really trying to understand the world that they have to live in every day.
Right. And I mean, he is closer to Hollywood than many of us, so he probably sees it from a perspective we could never imagine.
Yeah. Like, I think it's really important to state, like, how much the actresses in the movie really connected with this film, too. Like, they actually talked about, like, I think Jenna Malone said something. Whenever she sees herself in her ideal reality, she is a badass, you know? So, like, being able to portray that in a movie was really interesting for them, and they really appreciated that Zack seemed to see them in a way and really be receptive to those struggles and putting that into a movie, which I mean, even years later, this cast has seemed to have stuck together. Like, whenever this film was being reevaluated around the time of the release of the Snyder Cut for Justice League, they actually had started being more vocal about the movie again and really appreciate it.
This is something a constant theme you see throughout Zack's film. Mm-hmm. Not just when we saw the Snyder Cut of Justice League, it was amazing just to see all the new stuff with the Amazonians and mm-hmm. how powerful and respected they were. And the cast just seemed so happy. And also another example is Snow, Steam, Iron. It's this short film that he shot on his iPhone, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I think it's on YouTube. If you guys haven't seen it, definitely check it out.
Yeah, it's in a few different places. It originated on his Vero account, but I think it's gone to YouTube, maybe Vimeo since then. But yeah, he is always, in every movie he has made, I feel, really made a point to highlight women as more than just a device for the men of his stories. I would say another really big example of this is in 300, with how he takes the Queen of Sparta, and in the graphic novel that he's adapting, she's really only a footnote, and he really gives her an entire arc, and is also played by Lena Headey, who is awesome. So he really is one of the only big Hollywood directors, I feel, that really understands how to spotlight women, because I know other male directors have started to do that more, but I still don't think a lot of them, some of them do, but I don't think a lot of them really get it still. You kind of have to still look for that from women directors.
And despite all of that, I think that's what's so sad about the way that Zack is seen by many people.
Mm-hmm.
Really the complete opposite of what he is. He's not misogynistic, you mm-hmm. know, even though he gets that on multiple films. But I think that could be a documentary to its own. Just, you know, misplaced, you know, I guess, hatred in some cases for Zack.
Yeah, it would make a really interesting documentary, I feel, someday. I don't know who would do it. I'd be interested in seeing it, though, but...
I do have something else that, you know, one of the more interesting theories I've come across is that a lot of the film, I guess, could be seen through the lens of the stages of grief.
Yeah, that's an interesting take.
So let me just run down some notes here. So the first stage could be denial or isolation. And at the beginning, she's seen alone. We can't forget that it opens with the curtain, you know, into the room. And so her whole life could be seen as a stage. I know I feel like that sometimes, but she may be in denial over the loss of her mother, or, you know, the fact that she's dealing with this abusive stepfather. She may feel alone during the first part of the asylum because she hasn't quite figured out the landscape yet. She hasn't gotten to meet everyone and, you know, let them in on who she is. Then you have the second stage, which is anger, which is something we see a lot of in the film, whether it's her extreme fantasies of slaying dragons or beating up the Germans. There's tons of examples of that. You know, attacking the stepfather with the gun or the chef with the knife. The third stage of grief is bargaining. This could be seen as sort of the moment where she mentions the five items to the girls, or at least the four items, I guess.
Yeah.
That they need to, and she lays out the plan. It's a bargain for, you know, if you help me achieve these, then we can access freedom, essentially. The fourth stage is depression, which could be seen as the divide between the girls. And, you know, Sweet Pea backs out because when she realizes, you know, sort of the danger. Also, it really lets me know that, like, Sweet Pea really is, in some ways, the central character of the film, just because she goes through these stages almost more than anyone. You know, right before the third act, you know, it's largely known that, like, the protagonist will have, like, a all-is-lost moment or a dive before the eventual rise, and or a sense of, like, contemplation, like in Star Wars when Luke doesn't know what he should do. Should he go meet with Ben Kenobi and start his training? The fifth and final stage is acceptance. I guess you could say there's lots of stages in the movie that could be seen as acceptance, but it could be when Baby Doll realizes her fate, or that she's the fifth item, or that it's not really her story, perhaps. What do you think about that?
I actually think that's a very interesting and pretty valid take, too. I like that one quite a bit. Like, that's one thing about this movie, and I think it's very fitting that this is the first film that I really cover on this podcast, because one thing I really want to bring home in every episode I do is that film is very subjective, no matter how many people try to Absolutely. Tell you it's objective in any way. Like, storytelling is a very subjective thing. Art in general is. So to cover a movie that is this layered and can have so many different interpretations is very interesting, because all of the events that take place in the film they're there. Like, all the pieces are there, but how people see those things, how people project their own ideas and experiences to it, it really recontextualizes the film in very different ways. And I think that take of it being an allegory for grief is very interesting too, and it makes sense considering the movie starts with two tragedies back to back. Baby Doll's mother dying and her accidentally killing her sister. There is a tremendous amount of grief that this character is going through. So I think it's very reasonable to think that the story that's taking place is really a parallel to those stages of grief, especially since the end of the movie is acceptance, that she can't really change her fate, so to speak. And she can't change what she did either. There's a lot there I think is interesting. Then, of course, the take of it being a commentary on women in entertainment and the pop culture zeitgeist, and just in the real world, how there really was a very strong male power dynamic. I mean, there still is today, but even worse in the 1950s, around the time whenever this movie takes place. There's so many different ways to, and also another thing, like how I said earlier, it directly quotes Mark Twain about illusions. And if you dive into Zack Snyder, he really is obsessed with the illusion of filmmaking. And so I feel like this is the closest he's actually gotten to exploring that idea of what illusion actually means, and how illusion can actually be very truthful. And it's not just this lie. Illusion is just as much a part of your reality as anything else. And I feel Zack Snyder is of a similar belief to Mark Twain, where if you just throw away the illusion, there's just no point in living, essentially. And I think that's another thing that the movie's touching on, is like how necessary illusion is for us to cope with our lives.
I would agree. Reality is definitely very subjective.
Yeah.
It's funny. I guess a lot of people think, you know, we see the same things on social media or the same news, and so they think everyone must live the same exact life through their exact lens, but we should probably stop and think about other people's perspective every once in a while. This movie is full of that. It's full of other people's perspectives, and I love what Zach has to say in a lot of his movies, just about really the struggles that minorities go through. Is another theme that I see, a recurring thing. Yeah, I respect Zack Snyder a lot for that.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's this movie, I mean, much like a lot of his movies, but I feel especially this one just very ahead of its time. And I do really hope that it keeps being reevaluated, and eventually someday we see the definitive cut of the movie.
I can't wait.
I would love to see, you know, the full picture of what Zack Snyder really wanted this movie to be, which is interesting whenever you hear him talk more about it, because he is kind of upset with himself with how many compromises he had to make while making this one. I don't know, like, I still think it's a great movie. I love it. You know, like I said, it's my favorite out of his entire filmography so far, and he's like probably my top five favorite filmmakers working today. So yeah, that's pretty much all I have to add.
Awesome. Yeah, my personal favorite Zack Snyder film is Batman v Superman, which is another film which got an extended cut later. And, you know, lots of people, finally came around to that, too, once they saw the extra 30 minutes or whatever it was, you know, put back in the film. So that seems to happen a lot to Zack.
Yeah, it happens way too much to this guy, which is very unfortunate.
Very.
But I think currently he's in a good place. You know, he's working with Netflix on his current films, which is another thing I want to point out. This is actually, Sucker Punch is actually his first original film.
Exactly.
Everything else that he made up until that point and quite a few after that were just adaptations of or remakes in the sense of like Dawn of the Dead. They were basically just his reimaginings of other people's work. And he made them his own, for sure, but...
Which could also explain why this movie is so layered, too.
Yeah.
He just had so much to say at that point.
Yeah, like, Sucker Punch is a movie that is a lot to take in, but I think it's really telling that, with it being his first original film, that he's able to really have so much to say. And he's not just, you know, relying on other people's stories. He is continuing to do that now, because we have, like, Army of the Dead, we have Rebel Moon coming out.
I'm so excited for that.
Yeah, and then he has other original films on the way, too. So, you know, I think that's really cool. I'm glad that he has kind of gone into making more original works, so that way we get to see more of how his mind works, like, entirely, and I'm looking forward to it.
I guess I could end what I have to say with restore the Snyder punch, I think is the attack that's been going around.
Yeah. I think it's something like that. But yeah, those are our thoughts on Sucker Punch. I hope you guys enjoyed that. And Krista, is there anything you would like to plug?
You can check me out on, I have Twitter and Instagram. I'm Krista Michaels on both.
Okay.
So I think at Krista Michaels X on Twitter and then Krista Michaels on Instagram. My latest short film I've just finished, Manted, is, I've just submitted to several different film festivals, so I'll keep the feeds up to date on what becomes of that.
Your other short film is on, that's on Troma, right?
Troma Now, yes, yeah. The streaming service. It's called One Monday.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Gwen Loves Movies. I am also on Instagram under the same handle. And I am also, as I said in the introduction episode, I am also working on a couple scripts, one in particular, currently titled Trap. It is a conversion therapy horror film, I guess you could say, although not like They Them, which recently released. Nothing like that. I don't want to be associated with that one. I'm not talking about that movie on this podcast. And several other ones that I'm kind of developing, because as artists, I don't think we ever just work on one project at a time. But yeah, until the next episode, go ahead and stay safe and listen in next time. Bye.
Bye.